This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbone, and I'm coming to you live from lockdown Sydney, Australia, where I'm a senior lecturer in history at Macquarie University. We are locked down, so if you hear any noise in the background, that's probably my three-year-old. But hopefully we're mostly hearing from Peter Rubal, who's our guest today. He is a senior research fellow at the Institute of Contemporary History at the Czech Academy of Sciences. Before we got together, he was telling me all about how great that is. And he is the author of Spartakiads, The Politics of Physical Culture in Communist Czechoslovakia, that was published by Carolinum Press and the Institute of Contemporary History in 2019. Although for the Anglophone audience, mostly for maybe the American audience, it's being distributed by University of Chicago Press. So that might be also a convenient place to locate it. Welcome, Peter, to New Books in Sports.
Hi, Keith. It's a pleasure to have the chance to talk to you, and thanks for the introduction.
I have to tell you, I was fascinated by the book. I've always wanted to know more about both the Sokol movement and the Spartakiad movement in Czechoslovakia. And it's embarrassing for me to admit, as a European historian and as a sports historian, I really didn't know as much as I wanted to. But your book fixed that right up. Let me tell you, I loved it. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got into Spartakiad as a project? How'd you develop this project?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I hope I will not discourage the listeners, who, as I assume, are mostly sport historians, because I'm actually not sport historians, and my book is not directly sport history. But given that, I really think it's relevant still for sport historians. I got to the topic from quite strange angle, basically from the angle of studying the legitimacy of communist regime. And this, if I can do a little sort of personal introduction to that, because it's a bit complicated. I'm coming into the history of communism from my own experience of growing up under the old regime. But my experience is very specific and narrow. Both my parents were anti-communist activists. My father was even imprisoned for a short time for printing illegal books under communism, the so-called samizdat literature. And I even remember as a child reading sort of the illegal published Lord of the Rings and meeting all these cool alternative culture people and former reform communist politicians of the Prague Spring. So we were moving in that sort of very narrow group of anti-communist activists. The communism fell when I was 14, so I experienced that quite actively. But the problem with, so that raised a lot of questions for me, how communism could operate for so long and so on. But as a personal experience, this was not very useful to understand or get to the answers to these questions, because that was a group of about 2,000 people maximum, maybe actually much less, who had this sort of active resistance experience. And the rest of the population sort of made some sort of arrangement much more practical than my parents did. So from very sort of early on, I was really curious how this works for the other people. Yeah, so for me, this was a question that I needed to answer through sort of anthropological inquiry into the sort of unknown culture. So this is really like the communist past is a foreign country for me in that sense. So I approached it as something that really puzzled me. And the Spartakiads were probably the most extremely puzzling phenomena that, you know, you have synchronized movements on tens of thousands of people at the stadium, willingly sort of embodying the ideals of communism. And that sort of didn't square with my experience at all. And so I started to study it as sort of an exploration into sort of manipulation, how people were manipulated into that, into doing that. I couldn't believe that they did it voluntarily, or, you know, it was sort of a mystery for me. So I started very much from sort of Hannah Arendt perspective and this sort of totalitarian view. But then I started to talk to people, and I very quickly changed my mind. And I started to look more as sort of social anthropology or cultural anthropology perspective on the subject. And I was led by some great people towards sort of better understanding than the totalitarian narrative. So if I maybe might mention a few of these people who worked with me at the or who led me actually at Central European University and then at Cambridge University. This really inspired me to improve the sort of the original design of the project, which was just sort of curiosity how something like that is possible. So it was especially István Réf at Central European University who sort of opened my eyes to this issue of politics of aesthetics, and that sort of is I try to bring into the topic. Then Paul Connaughton and Cambridge, with whom I drank actually one or two bottles of Chilean wine, who sort of taught me to appreciate Marxism and critical theory. Then Nikolai Sorin-Chaikov, who helped me to navigate in the sort of classics of cultural anthropology, especially to rediscover Clifford Geertz. Those discussions were also accompanied by a beer or two. So in fact, I was drinking quite a lot in my short stay at Cambridge, I have to say. And I was lucky to be mentored by Jiří Musil, a founder of urban sociology in Czechoslovakia, who sort of taught me to be sensitive to the urban and spatial dimension of my research. And this much later then inspired me to move to urban history as sort of my next or current research. And also probably the last name to mention is Henning Eichberg, a German-Danish sociologist of sport, who really sort of emphasized the point that I sort of knew but was not aware enough, and that is sort of the importance of nationalism in sport. So these were sort of all the inspirational sources that I think sort of led to this project.
Yeah, I was really, I mean, I'm glad that you're getting into some of your kind of theoretical underpinnings, and I want to jump into that in a second. But I think for listeners who maybe don't know, and I think, you know, that's probably a majority of them, maybe even, can you just give us a quick, you know, 60 seconds on what was the Spartakiad? I know that you wrote the whole book about it, but you mentioned it's about kind of rhythmic, you know, mechanical movement. But if you were at a Spartakiad as a spectator, what would you have seen?
Yeah, this is a bit a challenge to translate that into words, because if you see the picture of that's very sort of obvious, and especially for older generation, you immediately know what I'm talking about. Basically, it's a mass exercise, sort of aerobics on great scale. It's a sort of rather simple gymnastic exercises that sort of lasted about 10-15 minutes, and then they were replaced by another performance. These were performed at stadiums in Prague, actually in specially designed stadium, the biggest stadium in the world, which still holds the that sort of position. And it is it has sort of long tradition going to the 19th century nationalism, and it has very sort of explicit anti-sport a message. Yeah? So this is not about competition, this is about cooperation. There are no winners, no losers. This is very close to a ritual, political ritual or sporting ritual, but it's a lot about politics quite from the very beginning. Okay? So the synchronized movement of people exercising first to some sort of mechanical beats and later to the music was very effective sort of a way of symbolizing some sort of ideas. We will probably get later to that. I'm afraid I'm well over the 60 seconds for introduction of that on that topic, but it's sort of highly modernist project where you distribute the bodies on the exercising field in very strict geometrical order, and then sort of the success of this exercise is in the synchronicity, so that everyone does the movement exactly the same at the same moment as all the others. And that also means that it needs to be pretty simple, because you need to master the movements. Yeah? So it's quite far apart from competitive sport.
Yeah, I when I was reading about it, of course, I kind of had a sense of what it was. I initially thought, oh, maybe it's like the French natural method, the Hébertiste method. And then I realized in reading it, oh, it's not like that at all. So then I got on to YouTube and looked up some Sokol, some Spartakiad to try to see if I could find some examples. And you can. And it immediately reminded me of the 2008 opening ceremony to the Beijing Olympics, this kind of like mass synchronicity, which, as you say, is kind of muscular and physical, but not sporty. And I was thinking about the way in which people talked about those Olympic opening ceremonies as being kind of particularly communistic. But you take on that idea that, and not to reject it, but to grapple with it, the idea that the Spartakiad is a kind of communist ritual. So I'm wondering, like, for you, and this is kind of, I guess, asking your big conclusion before we dig into the nitty gritty. Why is it a problem to look at the Spartakiad simply as a kind of communist ritual? Is this about self-Sovietization after 48? Or is there a kind of Gertzian perspective and even kind of a Czech only thing going on, a kind of Czech nationalist perspective going on in the midst of the communist era? So can you kind of give us your big conclusions before we dig into the the smaller details, I guess?
Well, I think that there is something communist about it. You can definitely read it into it. But given the fact that the practice as a cultural practice, it preceded the communism for nearly 100 years, or so, sort of at least 80, 70 years. So that in itself shows in Italy that this is more about adaptation of certain culture practice by communism than anything else. That in itself is nothing unusual. Yeah? Communism or state socialism was very, very good at adopting the previous cultural practices, and this is one of the reasons for its longevity. Yeah? And then there is, of course, what you just said about the specificity of the Czech project, yeah? Because the Spartakiads, as you rightly said, resemble sort of the opening ceremonies or whatever they do now in North Korea. But unlike in other countries, the Czechoslovak Spartakiads were ritual on its own. Sort of the mass gymnastic displays didn't open anything, didn't conclude anything. It was the thing. Yeah? So just the display itself was what really sort of mattered there. So in that, it's quite specific. So again, if it's specifically Czechoslovak, then how that could be communist? Yeah, that's also is a bit of question. And of course, for us as historians, to look at 40 years period of communism, or in case of Soviet Union, 70 years, and say, you know, it has one character is really strange. So what I try to put in my book is also that these things change over the time. So it means one thing in 1950s, it means something different in 1980s, and that's quite natural. And you would assume in another context, like French context that you know so well, you wouldn't think that this would be the same thing, that there would be some sort of French sport and it wouldn't change over time. Yeah, so this is also one of the sort of misconceptions about communism, that it's sort of frozen in time and it doesn't evolve. Yeah, so that's another sort of caveat. Again, I'm not doing the job right as you've asked me to give my conclusion. I'm just sort of circling around the topic that it's really not as much communist ritual as something much broader.
And that's the richness of your book, though, is that it actually takes that for me mm-hmm. was that it takes what might be our pre-assumptions about this kind of Spartakiad ritual. And anyone, I mean, sports historians, they read about Spartakiad and they read it within, I think, the context of communism. And you actually paint a picture that says, oh, this is much more about something particularly Czech. That's, you know, my understanding of it about Czech state socialism, but even more about Czech nationalism.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was the point with the, where I was deeply sort of inspired by Guy Clifford Geertz was sort of the autonomy of the ritual, in this case, the Spartakiads. Yeah, so it's not that the ritual serves the state, but the state serves the ritual. Yeah, it's really creates its own sphere in which the state is only one of the actors. It has its own meaning and its own tradition. The state simply cannot interrupt that tradition without enormous cost. And we might go back to that because it actually did happen at one time,
yeah.
But very critical time. Yeah. So that's what I took from Geertz, this sort of, that this is some sort of negotiation. The ritual is a negotiation about power. Yeah? It's not disguising the power. It's, you don't need to sort of actually use sort of Marxist tools for that. You don't need a psychoanalysis for that. You can actually look at the ritual itself and try to understand what's going on. And you don't need to actually look into the heads of the leaders to know what is the meaning, because the meaning is right there in front of you. Yeah? I know, this is really simplification. Yeah, you wanted it so now.
No, it's good. It makes me want to jump ahead to your fourth chapter on kind of the organization, because what I should give a quick rundown. Your first chapter, which we'll move to in a second, deals with the kind of genealogy, and you've already remarked on kind of the longer history of this kind of specifically Czech gymnastic movement. And then you look at kind of the early period and later period post-normalization within the Spartakiad. And then you have two chapters at the end that kind of, in many ways, overlap the whole of the period you examine. Mm-hmm. What first is on the organization of the Spartakiad, and then the fifth chapter is on society and the Spartakiad, kind of looking at how do people react to it. But your fourth chapter on organization of the Spartakiad, really, I loved it because the full cost of this to the state socialist system became so clear, and you're like, oh my God, how much money are they spending on these events every 5 years? It was just kind of an immense undertaking.
Yes. That is exactly the point. They simply too much for their own sake. It was ruining the system, and that's what exactly Geertz describes at Bali. That actually there is a sort of kink that serves the Pope. His entire sort of politics is about providing the ritual for the people, and there are some great books on that, on antiquity, where also this bread and circuses. It's not only about sort of the cynical game, but it's much more complex. The interaction between the ritual and the power is much more complex than being usually sort of under this laying interpretation of Marxism we sort of assume, I think.
So then how does to jump then in a poor transition into your first chapter, how does this kind of gymnastics movement become such an all-pervasive feature of Czech society? Like, where does this come from? And I guess I've mentioned Sokol before, but can you give us some of this long genealogy?
Okay, so I trace it into the two sort of roots. So first, maybe I will start with the thing which is more obvious, and that is sort of Czech nationalism that emerges in the mid 19th century as sort of organized nationalism, to use Miroslav Hroch's sort of phases of nationalism, very useful sort of tool to work with, and this is a time of sort of nationalist movements that use the relative liberty that operates in Habsburg monarchy, and they compensate for the fact that Czechs and many other nations do not have national institutions. So the movements are sort of filling this vacuum in very specific way, and I call it sort of gymnastic Sonderweg in my book, because I think this function of sporting movements, which replace the state institutions and replace them by sort of national movements, are then giving them a specific character that is different from the development in Western Europe, and especially in Anglo-Saxon meaning of the sport. Yeah, so this sort of allergy to competitiveness, for example, is something that I think comes from this idea that these nationalist movements are actually national institution, and because they are national institution and not state institution, they do not have a natural boundaries. Yeah, so they are quite naturally sort of expansive and relatively aggressive nationally, because they are not tied by the state borders. The Sokol movement was founded in the 60s by a professor of aesthetics, Miroslav Tisch, who was a German by origin, and he modified his name, and I made a bit of fun of him in my book, where I describe the, I think, four or five stages in which he changed the name from typical German name into a Czech one, and then he copied a German, quite well-established German model of this gymnastics or Turner movement into the Czech environment. And I mean copied. Yeah? There was very little change in that. He created terminology, which is very typical for those nationalist movements, that they take something from as a package, but they need to label it locally. Yeah? So this is copied to the Czech environment from the German word, with which Kirsch was intimately sort of connected. And Thomas Garrick Masaryk made fun of this. Yeah? And he said, like, how can you fight against the German dominance by adopting everything from Germany, especially if this movement, the so-called movement, is led by two Germans, because the other founder was also of German origin. Masaryk later sort of regretted his sort of remarks, because when during the war he was building the Czechoslovak nation abroad, he depended heavily on the infrastructure of the Sokol movement, which became sort of the most powerful national movement shortly before the First World War, and was sort of backbone of the Czechoslovak army abroad, which famously captured Siberia for a while. Yeah. So the Sokol movement copied the German practice of so the Turner movement. I don't think I need to explain sort of the origins of that in detail, but then there were some modification of that, because for the German Turner movement, the crucial thing was the unification of Germany. And therefore the synchronized gymnastics in the same sort of uniform, in the same movement, at the same time, actually, across Germany, was a way to overcome the disintegration of the German states and create sort of at least imaginary state or imaginary collective body in the minds of the gymnasts. And this is something that the Czechs were not that worried about. They were much more worried about the size of the nation and its near disappearance at the end or during the 17th, 18th century. Yeah, so the unification was not such a crucial issue at that time. So they tried to overcome the smallness of the nation, but they didn't really have tools for that. So I think from there, the focus on aesthetics came. So they needed to overcome the Germans, but they couldn't do it by the size. So they tried it by the perfection. And that also fits to the project of Tirsch, who was, expert in aesthetics. And he tried to change the Sokols into sort of the perfection of the statues of antiquity. Yeah? By the way, in the book, little advertisement for the book, Tirsch is there depicted naked, actually, from both sides, because that was part of that project. Yeah? So he was perfecting the body of Czechs into the antiquity ideal. And of course, that also meant that the male body was to be displayed naked, at least in these portraits of him. He's extremely interesting a character in itself. He then commits suicide mysteriously in the Alps, and he suffers mental illness throughout the period of the establishment of the movement. And he's also a great, I think, example of how the Czech nation is created in very short span of time. Here I would refer to a famous Czech scholar, Matsura, who inspired me a lot by his work. And he speaks about sort of this creative nature of the Czech nationalist movement, but also many other nationalist movements, that you can create at that time really a word for yourself, even if it's just this little Czech word. Yeah. So Miroslav Tirsch comes to Prague as a young, ambitious man, and he finds the Czech nationalist movement very attractive and very promising for his own future. He wanted to come to Prague to establish a Shakespeare club, but discovers that there is already one. So he thinks about, okay, well, what else I know? And he was already a gymnastic trainer in a private institution. So he founds this And because nothing is done yet, yeah, so everything is open for him. So he recreated himself, and he also sort of in this way recreates the nation and try to reshape it. And one of the key slogans of the Sokol movement was "Every Czech a Sokol."
Every Czech a Sokol, right?
Well, yeah, he tries to create a. Sorry,
I was going to say, this first chapter is you cover a lot of ground. It's really rich. What you do in terms of framing Sokol as this kind of key nationalist institution that helps bring together the Czech nation, but that also, because it's maybe so pervasive, more so than other national institutions, helps shape through its aesthetic the kind of ideal of the Czech state later, both in this first Republic period, and then in the socialist period as well. And for people who are interested in the kind of interwar body politic, I want to. There's not just naked drawings of Tirsch. There's a really good discussion of the kind of body politics of different gymnastic movements, and the Germans being maybe too focused on their upper body. There's a lot of, I think that's obviously a conversation that's ongoing, but people interested in kind of this pan-European conversation about the ideal body type, national body types, should these body types be the same? Are each nation composed of people who are essentially different and thus need different body types? That's all there. But eventually, of course, we get to the geopolitical movements which help shape things too, and we come into the communist period. So the communists, when they come to power, they are face to face with this Sokol movement that they have to deal with. So what are they? You know, why doesn't Sokol disappear in 48? Why does it keep going? You've hinted at some of this already. We're jumping into chapter two, so take us into that period.
The Sokol nearly disappeared. It was quite close. First of all, as with many other things, communism simply inherited very complex society that they needed to govern somehow. And the Sokol movement was the biggest movement that they encounter. Yeah, it had, after Second World War, it had a million members. And everyone who meant something was Sokol. And they quite cleverly decided to disband their own sporting organization, which of course they had in interwar period, because Communist Party was legal, unlike in other Central European countries. They could operate here. But they dissolved their own organization and asked their members to join Sokol. And they argued that the sporting organizations should be unified. And it was a time of great sort of centralization that was not only a communist project, it was more general trend that sort of so-called the national revolution needs to be done by sort of great unification. And we need to get rid of the sort of the plurality that destroyed the First Republic, that means the interwar republic. So they first tried to cooperate with the Sokol movement. And they also faced a practical problem that they took over the country in February 1948. But already for 5 years or 4 years, the new Sokol Sled, which was the major gathering of all the Sokols where these performances took place, was in preparation. So they had a practical problem, and in a few months' time, they had somehow to control something that they didn't prepare. So they either could cancel it or let it go. And they, instead of going against the Sokol, they decided to try to incorporate them into the new regime. They went ahead with the organization of this sled in 1948. Unfortunately for them, it did turn into a massive sort of demonstration against the communist regime. That probably was the only time they really were challenged on that sort of grand scale where thousands of people were sort of cursing them and publicly displaying disloyalty to them. And based on this experience and also the pressure from the Soviet Union, was that it looked that this type of exercising will disappear from the cultural practice of communism. But then Stalin died 9 days later. Our local Stalin, Clement Gottwald, died. So he went to burial and got the flu and died. And there was a political sort of vacuum there and symbolic vacuum, because Stalinism and its legitimacy rested on the figure of the leader. Suddenly the leader was not there. There was even criticism of the leader and the cult of leader. And you needed to have a symbolic representation of the collective body. And unlike in Nazism, the communists didn't really have an option to represent the Communist Party as the embodiment of the nation. Just think about the meetings of the Central Committee of Communist Party of the Soviet Union or Czechoslovakia. You know, this is a very boring event. Yeah? This is a lot of old people in ill-fitting suits sitting there and listening to long speeches. That's not, you know, that will not move anyone. And it also doesn't symbolize the people, because it symbolizes the party, which is exclusive, and it should be exclusive. Yeah? So they needed a new symbol of the nation. Yeah? And they look back to the tradition of the so-called movement and sort of adopted it very sort of systematically. They hired the so-called to organize it for them. They made all kind of concessions so this would work, but they changed the name of the event from so-called sled to Spartakiad. That referred to the tradition of left-wing gymnastics, and it then also sort of dissolved the organization of the Sokol. Yeah, so the Spartakiads are essentially Sokol sleds, yeah, in all their aspects, but without the Sokol movement. And the communist regime was very systematic in never allowing any movement emerging from the gymnastics. Yeah, so they adopted the form, but the content, so to say, they didn't allow. Yeah, so I think this is in a nutshell what happened. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, this chapter, I think, is really, I mean, for people interested in the aestheticization of physical culture in Czechoslovakia, this chapter is the one to read, because you very deftly weave between kind of readings of the Spartakiad as a kind of socialist realist ceremony or ritual, but also against it, and in navigating the ways in which the organizers themselves were trying to figure out what socialist realist physical culture was. Because it couldn't be like fascist physical culture. It couldn't have a kind of organicist model. It needed something different. What was the relationship between discipline and spontaneity within the Spartakiad? What was the new model for gender? how were they going to employ folklore? So can you talk a little bit about the kind of, not so much the model, but what was the aesthetic underpinning it, at least before normalization, right?
Yeah, and I will probably get to that. There's a real shift there later on. These are really sort of socialist realist event in their aesthetics, and I think has sort of, again, great political implications. I think the best example would be to look at what's happening with gender, and it's slightly complicated, but I think, you know, I'll manage to explain it. similarly to what happened to class or nationalism, national identity, Stalinism sort of draw very clear lines around these identities, but then actually it assigned them quite arbitrarily. So gender and gender distinction plays enormous role in the Spartacus 55-60, but they very different from the previous times. Gender is simply a marker of difference, okay? But it has no tie to some sort of idea of natural, so-called natural roles of the genders or sexes. And, you know, it just uses as sort of a part in the great machine that drives towards the socialist progress. And I think this, to maybe simplify it, this is basically using the principle of mosaics. Yeah? So the individual bits that you compose the image from needs to be very well defined, clear cut, unproblematic, and then you assemble them quite arbitrarily into sort of one big sort of story or image. Yeah? But that doesn't, you know, you can move them as you like. You are the master of the narrative as the leader. Yeah. So you are not tied by the tradition or organicist sort of metaphors and so on. Yeah. So it's very, very arbitrary. And so and this later on changes quite radically. It's also the 50s are typical for employing avant-garde artists. So there are sort of mass choreography of the bodies with very little sporting content. I described there one performance. It's called, I think, New Shift Begins. And in that performance, thousands of male gymnasts are forming huge cogwheels on the surface of the stadium. And as they are running, the cogwheels are turning. While the women are performing something that should resemble lines of wheat waving in wind, yeah? So extremely sort of explicit symbolism. Also, the movements of the bodies are very sort of stylized, very symbolic. Yeah? Very often they are actually showing some other movement. So they exercise in order to display like work or leisure activities. At some points they are actually, you know, doing movements that should show sporting activities. Yeah. So they are not doing sport, they are showing sport. Yeah? Right. So it goes into quite absurd sort of lengths to imitate the socialist aesthetics.
But as you've already alluded to, and as you discuss in your third chapter, this changes pretty significantly after the Prague Spring and after the cancellation of the 1970 Spartakiad. So maybe you can talk us through a bit how the Spartakiad is impacted by this new era. What happens and how does the Spartakiad change?
Yeah, so I think that's really a profound change, because I think that the regime actually changes dramatically after Soviet intervention in 68. I have some serious doubts how much communist it is after that year. Yeah? So the legitimacy of the regime changes dramatically. It no longer aspires to transform the society, but to pacify it. So the preferences are completely different, and that shows in the Spartakiads as well. I describe in my book sort of this strange dialogue that the government was trying to create with the population. Yeah? So they were guessing at what sort of symbolism the population is willing to accept and what is already too far. And of course, it's a strange dialogue because the other side does not respond. Yeah? So it's just guessing what is acceptable and what is not. So you see a sort of nationalization of the performance. Yeah? So now all the symbols are national symbols. You also see the return to the so-called model of representation of the body. So it tries to get rid of all the additions to the sort of symbolic power of the body. So, for example, if you look at the transition of the army performances, yeah, the soldiers in the 50s were performing in uniforms with weapons. The tanks were going through the stadium and so on. Yeah? Now they are nearly naked. Yeah? They are, and their body, their physically strong body, which is organizedly sun tanned, yeah, was part of the military training, was that they were lying and getting proper sun tan for the performance. This is, you know, this uses the well-established sort of connotations of that strong male body or attractive female body. All these sort of stereotypes are mobilized in pretty brutal fashion, especially if you look at what's happening with the symbolism of female body that is not emancipatory in any sense. I think some of the examples that I show in my book are quite shocking. Yeah, the way the women are pushed to symbolize very traditional supportive role, how they are tied to natural cycles of reproduction and natural myth, historical myth, and so on. While it becomes
I think you mentioned in the book as well, it becomes a much more kind of Foucauldian, almost biopolitical ritual. Post-normalization. Yes. Now, the one thing I would point out that I thought was really interesting is that it wasn't just young people. It was also older people as well, mm-hmm. that even people with gray hair, they were kind of wanted to emphasize family life as well as just the kind of usual categories of youth and exuberance.
Yes, that's true. And actually, it was very inclusive and it has some positive aspects in that sense. So it was exactly, it was performance for quite old, especially older men, yeah, because the men were no longer terribly attractive to these exercises. So in fact, they were getting older each 5 years, the same men were performing. Okay? So they were getting older and older and they had to adapt to that. So the exercising this were simpler, so they would cope with it. And also on the other end of the spectrum, they try to include mothers, sometimes fathers as well, with very small children. So from 2 years old, the normal was about three, four. They had sort of common exercises with, you know, mothers and children. Something that was unthinkable in the 50s and 60s, where the idea was that the children actually should be sort of taken away from the family environment and be socialized. Yeah? And there was a very explicit discussion about it, that this is not acceptable. I interviewed the founder of this practice of exercises of mothers with children, and she described how difficult it was for her to convince the leadership that this is good idea. And then suddenly in the 70s and 80s, this became the central ideological message. Yeah? This unity of mother and small child and imperfection of the children and how they actually didn't exercise but played with the sand on the stadium was something that was celebrated, not corrected. Yeah? So
I did want to know that I loved in obviously I read this in an English translation, but the what they called these children just misbehaving, quote unquote, or not doing what they're supposed to, soloists.
And that, yes, yes.
I had someone with a 3-year-old myself. I was like, oh yes. That's my daughter, a soloist.
Absolutely, but it goes against the logic of the performance, where, you know, the exercises make only sense if everyone does it at the same time. Otherwise, you know, why would you do it?
Yeah.
So, and there is a music to it. Yeah. So it's Yeah, but this tolerance of, and also that goes to for teenage boys, yeah, something that was sort of, they were strictly disciplined in previous Spartacan. Suddenly the discourse is, okay, well, they are, you know, they are teenage boys. They will do mistakes. They will come late. There is, you know, there's this sort of attempt to create inclusive ritual. And what was sort of shocking for me is how successful it is. So I sort of argue against some of the narratives of socialist rituals and also of the socialist regimes at towards the end of the existence, that it sort of was just, you know, dying and boring and so on. There is great energy there. Yeah. But then what I try to argue at the very end, that the times really change. Yeah. So I think what I speak about is not communist ritual, but modern ritual. And then, once we enter the postmodern era, the time is over for that. It's, yeah. So
it makes me think about how in your third chapter, you talk about the kind, and you continue to talk about that in chapters 4 or 5, the kind of feminization of Sokol as men, mm-hmm. many men kind of drop out because they prefer sport or something else. I do want to turn to chapter 4 and chapter 5. These were, I have to admit, my two favorite chapters because they're just so full of really funny details. For example, in chapter 4, you have a long discussion of the fact that maybe Sokol doesn't actually benefit the body in a real way. Yes. Like the ideologically, at least, it's supposed to create a more perfect body, but actually it perhaps doesn't. And when you compare that to the immense cost of the organization of the Spartakiad, you get a sense, a real sense, as you put it, it's the state in service of the ritual rather than the ritual in service of the state. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what it was like. I mean, how did they actually host these things? I think people might think we're thinking about 10,000 people, but how many people participated in a Spartakiad, and what were some of the difficulties that the state faced in organizing the whole thing in the first place?
Yes, that's a good question. No, the scale was completely different. So the training was done by 1 to 2 million people. Mm-hmm. Mostly, of course, the biggest number of that was the school kids, which somehow had to do it or were incentivized to do it. But then the about one-tenth of that number came to Prague to perform. So we speak about something about 200,000 gymnasts coming to Prague to exercise. Plus, of course, there is a lot of spectators. So I know it from, for example, my supervisor at Central European University, who happened to come to Prague accidentally at the time of the Spartacus, and he couldn't get accommodation because Prague was simply full. Yeah? So it was a major logistic challenge for the regime, which was barely coping as it was. Yeah, famously, in mid-80s, the factory for production of the toilet paper burned down, and there was, for a couple of months, there was no toilet paper in Czechoslovakia. Yeah? So it was really struggling to simply keep going. Yeah? And then suddenly it was able to organize such a major event. And there I play with the idea of sort of a moral economy and describes how this is actually perfectly logical. Yeah, so the communist regime was able to mobilize its resources for very short and specific task because it has this sort of planning capacity. And it also served as a great symbol and sort of invigoration of the regime. Yeah? If we can do this, we can do whatever we try to achieve. Yeah? So, but then, on the other hand, they relied heavily on the well-established practice of how this is done and how the Sokol movement always did it. Yeah? So, for example, it looks like impossible task to accommodate 200,000 gymnasts in Prague. Well, they canceled the school year earlier and put all these gymnasts into the schools where they slept on floor, used whatever bathroom facilities there were in the schools, yeah, so it was very primitive. Then they used army to feed the people. But there were some major logistical headaches, especially surrounding the transport and also how to entertain these people after they perform. Yeah? So this is something that I also work with, the contrast between the perfect discipline at the stadium and the complete chaos right after the performance is ended, where it really turned into sort of carnivalesque atmosphere in Prague, where police basically retreated from the public space as much as they could. They try not to use any heavy tactic because they want people to enjoy the event. They let people drink heavily, and they just recorded the costs of, you know, that they break down whatever the equipment there was available there. And the trains returned from Prague completely destroyed, especially the troubling where the miner, the apprentices who mining apprentices in Ostrava region, who then, you know, really used that carnivalesque atmosphere to get most of the opportunity to. It was not about striking back to the regime. It was more about sort of liberating at least for a few days from quite oppressive communist leadership.
You talk about, I would just mention one other thing in terms of like the actual organization of the Spartakiad that really struck me was that it often took longer for people to assemble in the stadium to actually walk through the doors and get onto the field than the events themselves, and that people complained about that. That gives you a sense of kind of the scope, because it just took so long for this many people to get out and to assemble at all these kind of predetermined spaces on the field that were marked out by these particular markers, and the markers had to be marked out years in advance, and they had to move them out because people's bodies changed.
Hundreds of people actually put the markers there. Yeah. So there was a sort of like military organization just to make the exercising field sort of operational.
Your fifth chapter deals entirely with this thing that you were just mentioning, which is, you know, how do people react to it? And I think most people's initial reading of it, based on a kind of sense that, oh, this is just a communist ritual, would put it within that frame of resistance versus, kind of acquiescence or acceptance. But your take is much more complicated. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how people responded to the Spartakiad, and even kind of then tracing it into the post-communist era. Is there a kind of Spartakiadology, if that's a word? I'm coining a neologism, I guess. But how do people respond to Spartakiad, and how do people feel about it now?
Yeah, so very, very briefly, a methodological point that I try to make in the books. When we speak of a communist society, we can debate whether it was communist or not, but we still should remember that it was a society. You know, communists never managed to create what they dreamed about, sort of unified people. So it was always very complex, modern society with all kind of classes of people and interests, and these interests conflicted. And of course, Spartakiads were one of the things that some people used against some other people, and were used for their improvement of their status and so on. Yeah? So this is again something that I tried maybe in vain that, you know, as we wouldn't speak, I think, about French society as monolithic, we cannot speak about the communist societies either. Yeah? So these are very complex societies that sort of interact. So each sort of group that I tried to sort of distinguish a bit reacted differently. Of course, the Sokols and their children, which, you know, we start with 1 million people already members, and then they have children, they pass this tradition on. These people were very enthusiastic in continuing what they thought was a so-called tradition under the different name. And then I think most of the other supporters were people who simply tried to enjoy as much as they could the offer that the communist system gave them through the Spartakiads and the generosity of the state. Yeah? So they were... the communist regime was very sort of gray, and suddenly there was something carnivalesque and very colorful. So of course they enjoyed it. But then there were people who were simply completely put off by that, especially in Prague. Lots of Prague people hated the fact that for a few days, once in 5 years, the villagers take over the capital. And they, if they could, they left the capital for their weekend houses. And they ridiculed the event. And we have quite a lot of evidence of this ridicule. And there were also resistance, yeah, to the event. But these were quite marginal. As far as the post-communist development, I think there is a great deal of nostalgia for the Spartakiads. And I think that relates to the general nostalgia for communism. And I think that relates to the experience of failure of the post-communist government and development. Yeah, so I think it was Adam Michnik who said that the worst thing about communism was what came after. Yeah, so I think that is roots of this sort of nostalgic feeling for Spartakiads as a time when a collective action was possible. Yeah, and there is, it's a reaction to excesses of neoliberalism and excesses of individualism as such. Yeah? And this longing for collective experience is something that we I think should take quite seriously and not just look at it. Okay, the old people are just reminiscing about the time when they were still healthy and could do sport. And I think there is some serious critique of the current era there.
Well, certainly, I think as humble as you're being in the interview, you've painted just a very vivid picture of a very particular Czech institution, and not a Czechoslovak. And in some ways, as you make clear in your book, mm-hmm. a very Czech institution. That whose disappearance in some ways in reduction in the post-communist era is a real loss for physical culture, one that's been kind of replaced or effaced by the sportification of these British games, mostly soccer, football, which is not necessarily, although I like soccer as much as the next person, maybe mm-hmm. more, it does lack, it is less than this Spartakiad and Sokol experience. I want to encourage listeners to really check this book out. Each one of the chapters is kind of rich in their own way. Whether it's your genealogical chapter, which gives a great history of this of gymnastics movements in Central Europe, to your chapters, your fourth and fifth chapters especially, which are kind of really fun. And informative and incisive discussions of, as you put it, the kind of generosity of the socialist state and the ways in which people were able to transform that generosity to their own aims and ends. It was really a fun read. I encourage people to pick it up. Peter, last question I always ask people, what can we look forward to reading from you next? You hinted that you've gone in an urban history direction. Is that?
Yes, absolutely. And specifically post Second World War Prague history. I'm now working on urban planning, and the link to Spartakiad is a bit tedious. Basically the Spartakiad took place on one Prague hill. So I covered one hill. I have a few more hills to cover in Prague. No, I'm actually, and I published just now with my colleagues, Brian Ladd and Matěj Spurný and Čaba Jelínek, a special issue of Journal of Urban History on sort of crisis of socialist modernism and the rise of sort of new neoliberal urban planning, or rather lack of it. so this is something that I work mostly on. It's also continuation with the Spartakiad project in the sense that I look at the role of experts and interaction of experts with the communist regime, whatever is that. And we discover that there is less of regime, or that they actually doesn't really exist as a regime. Yeah, it's a sort of collection of various interests and forces and experts seems to play an increasing, ever increasing role in running of the system as something that you would actually expect. Yeah. So urban planning is definitely my new area and urban planning of Prague especially.
Yeah, and we didn't talk about it at all in the interview today, but there's some really interesting sections on and urban planning and architectural symbolism within this work as well that I really appreciated. Although we did, like I said, we didn't talk about it, but for people who are interested in that, I encourage them to pick it up as well. I've been speaking today with Peter Rubal. He's a senior research fellow at the Institute of Contemporary History at the Czech Academy of Sciences, and he's the author of Spartakiad, The Politics of Physical Culture in Communist Czechoslovakia, which was published by Carolinum Press and the Institute of Contemporary History in 2019, but as I mentioned earlier, it's being distributed by University of Chicago Press as well. Thank you so much for joining me, Peter.
Thank you, Keith, very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. You've been listening to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbone, and I'm coming to you from Sydney, where I'm a senior lecturer in history in the Department of History and Archaeology at Macquarie University. Thank you for listening.